that they can have.
Sorry about the short delay. We have a few technical problems here, as usual. I'm Sander Geiken. I'm here to welcome you on behalf of the club. We're glad you're here, glad you came. We have an excellent congress for you. We've been putting a lot of effort in it, a lot of organizing. We have more than 80 talks from a wide range of topics involving society, community, making, hacking, culture, science, everything. We have all these lightning talks a lot this year. We have lots of projects going on. Just go around, explore, look at what people do, and a lot of stuff on the tables as well in the down on the floor A and everywhere. We have a lot of workshops. Of course, we have a huge social life here as well. We have a big lounge, DJs and everything. And of course, we're open 24 hours for all the 4 days. So have fun, enjoy life, enjoy technology, enjoy being here on the Congress. Be creative, make friends, and be here. Okay. I just want to say a little bit about the motto, then I'm going to give you a brief tour on the Congress and the whereabouts of everything, and then I'm going to introduce and hand over to John here. I think Nothing to Hide is really an excellent motto for the Congress. Of course, we've had a couple of notions already on the website to associate with that. Not only that we have this public opinion, I have nothing to hide, but also another few notions in terms of we have nothing to hide. We've had a lot of successes over the past year, and we shouldn't hide them. We should be proud of what we did and what we accomplished. Another notion was that there is nothing to hide anymore in today's surveillance society. There's just no way out to get a little privacy and that. But the thing I really want to turn on here in my just very brief introduction is, why is it still a major public argument? I mean, that's really one of the big problems we should address as activists, because it's actually been challenged for a long time. I mean, we've had a couple of arguments going on over the past years that nothing to hide is not even the main concern about surveillance. We have a lot of other concerns, you know. We have these stuff of automatic self-control, psychological effects in the panopticon. We have a mainstreaming monoculture of values. We have social sort going on with surveillance technologies, because you're always surveilled as someone. We have the connection, deep intimate connection between privacy and freedom, and all these connections we have with democracy, civil rights, all these notions we have in our state. We have these repressive capacities of surveillance techniques, and then we have all these other issues which we care for in a technical way as well, security risks, data leaks, technologies in the wrong hands, and all that. So there's a lot to worry about surveillance, not only that you have nothing to hide or anything. And then, in addition, it's not even a very valid argument. We can ask ourselves easily, do we want a society with nothing to hide, you know? And then you can easily come to a couple of points where that is not a good thing to have, you know? People can do the right thing and yet have to hide, like informants to the press, for instance. We see that the press actually lacks a lot of informants currently, because people are worried about surveillance and they're worried about the big bosses catching them anyway, no matter what data protection says. Then people can have weaknesses, you know, they can have illnesses or social problems, drug problems. And why do they have to tell that to all the world? You know, why do they have to be put into databases with that, and which are accessible from a number of state authorities, medical records, and so on, you know? Why shouldn't we just let them alone? And that's an idea of solidarity, to help them and not to question them. So why shouldn't they be able to hide that, you know? Another thing is, of course, that people can change as well. If you see stuff like school records, school databases, or medical records, which really record all the stuff you did wrong when you were a child, or all the medical problems you had when you were a child or when you were younger, you can change, I mean, over time. And why shouldn't you be able to hide that, you know? Why should these databases be some sort of eternal memory and keep all your weaknesses from the past and all your problems from the past available for everyone? And then the last argument, of course, is, well, you got nothing to hide today, but how about tomorrow, you know? How about if somebody comes to power who doesn't like people who wear red socks or whatever, you know? Then all of a sudden you've got something to hide, and that's how the situation can change. So nothing to hide. really is not a good argument. I think it's invalid, it's weak, and it's not the only argument you should consider when you're concerned with surveillance, but it's still very popular for the people, you know, and we have to ask ourselves, why is that so? And apparently the reason is because nobody told them about the other reasons we have to confront surveillance. And that's the point, I believe, where the motto points back to us, and where we have to say that we have to work harder to politicize the public. There's still a lot of knowledge which has to be brought out to the public, to the broader public, and the public still has to be politicized for our issues and our topics. And that concerns us because we are technologists with a political conscience, and a lot of what is happening in surveillance, in as much as in other stuff we're concerned with, like censorship, is happening in a very high-tech way. And only technical experts are able to understand what is going on, to understand in detail the potentials and the dangers of the technologies which are developed there, you know. So only we can understand that, and only we can alarm the public. We can tell them, hey, there's something fishy going on, you know, there's something shady, and we have to look at that in politics and the economy. Only we can explain that to them, and of course only we can develop countermeasures to stuff which is already going on, you know, like countermeasures to counter censorship in China, for instance. So we are really needed at the front lines of this particular battle. And what's even worse, it's quite clear that the battle will get tougher, you know, over time. The economy and the state always aim for more and more control. We have seen that over the last year. There's an exceeding interest in a couple of authorities, a couple of rationalities to actually enhance all the stuff that they're doing now, to enhance censorship, the commercialization of information, widening the digital divide. There's an exceeding interest to administer and control by means of data and databases. And of course, we have this big problem of the new paradigm of criminalistic intervention, which is currently being developed and followed worldwide, namely that crime fighting no longer has the idea of investigating a crime after it happened, but rather prevent it before it happens. And that, of course, is something which you can only realize by substantial use of surveillance, right? I mean, you have to constantly observe everyone who's potentially suspicious in order to catch him right before he commits a crime. And those are all things which are going on worldwide, on a worldwide scale, and which we have to worry about, because they are developing technologies, they're developing politics, and they're developing organizational structures, and that's all happening, and it's all happening rather fast. So there's a lot of work for us, actually. And remember our credo, you know, our idea is computers can change life for the better. That's something we have assigned to, that's something we know from personal experience. And of course it is something we want for society to be true as well, for the whole of society. So now is the time to actually work for that credo. You know? Now is the time to actually do something, go out there and work for that credo, make it happen on a broad scale, make it happen for the people. And that's what I want to give you as sort of a personal note to the Congress. Use the Congress, right? Prepare for political work. Inform yourselves. Arm yourselves. We've got a lot of talks here on political stuff, on political background, on laws which are currently being developed, on state authorities, economy authorities who are doing stuff, developing stuff. And so you can actually go there, see what's going on in the next year, see what will be happening, also get some background information on what you do. And then, of course, you can use the Congress as well to network with others. We have a lot of activists here. We have a lot of political projects on the Congress as well. And go there, meet them. They'll always be glad when you join them, when you show an interest in what they do. You're always welcome. And then, well, go out and activate something, you know. And I know, of course, that a lot is happening already. I've been traveling around Germany, visiting the regional groups of the CCC, and it's really tremendous what you guys do. I mean, really, there's so much going on, there's so much discussions, you're reaching out into the public, you're trying to do things, trying to get into the press, doing radio shows, everything. And that's all great, and thank you for that, right? That's really a great job you're doing, especially over the last year. And we have been able to scratch on the very surface of what is happening, you know, to scratch on the surface of the big things as well, and that's a very good thing. But we still need more. We need an ongoing pressure on this situation. We need the people to be concerned about it, especially now in the year where people will turn very much to their financial situations, to the world financial crisis. We have to pay attention that all these privacy issues, although the issues we are trying to defend, will not fall under the table. You know? So that's actually something we have to do, and that is something I would like to use the Congress for as well. So have fun, enjoy life, enjoy the Congress, but also be responsible, right? Look at, go to the political talks, inform yourselves, and try to involve yourselves into these projects. Okay, that's my short personal note, and now I'll just give you a little tour around the Congress. We have a couple of institutions, meanwhile, which you can use in the, on the Congress to do the stuff you want. We have the networking, of course, the NOC is doing that, and you can call them the help desk. On that number, I'm just going to show you where they're situated in a minute. We have the conference phoning. The POC is organizing that. You can get one of those deck phones, or if you brought one of yourself, you can get it tuned in on the Congress. You can call them under that number, 2000. Then, if you have an emergency, you can turn to the CARES emergency response teams as well. They're here or running all around the Congress. You can easily recognize them with their vests they're wearing. And you can call them under that number, if you have an emergency, they'll be there quickly help you. Then we have the lounge, of course, very important institution. It's just down underneath this room. There'll be a lot of DJs there. We have a big lineup, and we have a cocktail bar as well. So there's lots, a lot of stuff to relax and have fun. If you're speaking on the Congress, you should turn to the speaker's room. I'm going to show you in a minute where that is. And if you have any questions, of course, you can turn to the info desk and ask them about whatever you like, whatever question you ever had in your life. They can answer it. Really great guys. They're down on the first floor just behind the entrance. I'm going to show you that as well. You can see that here, that's the first floor, the entrance area. And there's a big thing, written information, that's where the info desk is. Then you have the speaker's room on the bottom left. And the big area in the middle, of course, is the lounge, the art and beauty stuff. We have also another DJ area down in the floor A. And go there, right? Look at the stuff happening. There's a lot of art and beauty going on, a lot of nice projects going on. The rest of the important stuff is on floor C, really. We have up there the POC, where you can get your phone programmed, up on the left, and then up on the right we have the Network Operations Center help desk, where you can go if you have a problem with networking. Okay, so that's the tour. Oh, that's not good. Now, some projects you should know about. As you all know, we have a lot of projects going on, a lot of interesting stuff, and it will be impossible to mention all the interesting things, but I just want to highlight a few to point you to some things you should not miss out on. One thing which I was asked to mention in the beginning was we have somebody doing simultaneous translations from German to English. So if anybody wants his German talk translated simultaneously to English, he should contact those guys. They're in the speaker's room. You can go down to the speaker's room just after the opening and ask for them, and they will come and translate. Then we have a great DJ lineup, which I mentioned already. It's going to be down in the lounge every evening. Then one very nice project, which is here now very prominently this time, is Hackerspaces, which is really an organization which is trying to build hackerspaces, to conceptualize hackerspaces. Very, very nice movement, very interesting, and you should go visit them. They have a talk here as well today, 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and they have a space out here as well, and I think in that corner. So go there, visit them. Of course, we have the Capture the Flag contest, which starts at day 3, 6 p.m. I think they're already very booked out, so if you want to participate there, go there, go early, and talk to them if you can still do that. And then we have the Hackerjopardy as well, which is also always very funny and always a conference highlights also here on day 3 at 11 p.m., a little later on. And then one very nice project which we have going on the Congress this year, which is entirely new, is the Open Beacon, Open AMD project from Sputnik. And they're going to tell you a bit about it now.
Thank you for the nice introduction, and thank you for the opportunity of allowing us to show you a little bit what we plan to do. So during the today or the following days, you will start to see appearing this poster in the areas. It's a poster to promote the project, Sputnik. So.
Quick question. How many people here were at the last Hope conference that was held this summer? Anyone? Okay, one person, two. Okay, single digits. Basically, people who have been to the CCC before may have seen the Sputnik project, which is basically triangulation of people. You wear a badge, you walk around, and we can show it's been... Pardon?
Ah, okay, there is this other keyboard connected to the machine now, right? Okay. So this is painful.
Oh, it's...
I'm sorry, there is another special keyboard connected to the screen somewhere.
So...
I try. I know this thing. So let's
always
do
happens
it.
Like this. So
let's
there's the badge.
Way.
Looks pretty cool.
So this is the badge. So it's RFID-based, active RFID-based badge with microprocessors and everything integrated in. So for those of you who have been here last year, this is okay, the same as before. But what's new, and we are really working very hard on that to get it actually working, is where we sense using a very interesting peer-to-peer connection scheme, social interactions between people wearing these badges. So the idea is that if a lot of you wear these, we can actually track you in real time with whom you are having contact and stuff. So I suppose you start to feel paranoid already. But let me just point out three things. We have three objectives with this project. The first is we want to have fun. You understand that, right? The second is that we want to make all of you kind of aware of what this technology can do. Because in the end, you are all carrying one of these, and these mobile phone companies are already capable of doing this kind of stuff today. So the only solution to hide, if you have something to hide, is to actually take out the battery from the RFID tag or from your mobile device, just to give you an idea. And then the third objective that we have is that we actually want to do science with this. We want to gather sufficient amount of data to analyze social interaction patterns that we can, for example, use to study epidemics and that kind of stuff. Really valuable and really life-saving, actually. So that's the three main objectives. We also have OpenAMD.
Right. AMD stands for Attendee Metadata. Basically, we thought it would be cool if you could
this
log
project.
Into a web interface
the first...
while the system is tracking you moving around and enter in personal information about yourself, whatever you want to enter, and have it track all this data along with you. So it's basically your own metadata as it goes along. So, for example, you could log in and you can say, I'm interested in lockpicking and nostalgia hacking. And it will actually hook you up with people, other people at the conference who have similar interests. Additionally, all the talks at the conference have interests assigned to them, so this actually recommends to you talks based on the interest that you have given.
So to give you a little preview of an application that will be accessible on the internet, so for everybody to see, is a live visualization of the contacts, of the social interaction as they occur and as they are as they have occurred during a day, for example. So people will be able to go there, type in the nickname or the ID of a device, and then see real-time visualization from which this is a screenshot of the testing. This is another one where we have a focus on several users and can see how these users are interacting. Do they know each other? Do they have like common friends? Stuff like that. It's basically giving the whole world the tools to observe all of you, but all of you who are wearing these tags, of course, how your social interactions are occurring during this conference. So, if you want more technical details on this stuff, there is a day four at 3:15. There is a talk by Ciro that will give more technical details, as I've said. So if you want to sacrifice your social privacy for only 10 euro, then you can get one of these at the food bud shop at level B. And also one little note, we are actually looking for some beta testers who can have one of these and test with us today.
Official triangulation is going to start tomorrow, which is when the Marauders map and all that goes up. So for today, the first, I think it's 50 people before 6 p.m., something like that, will get a free badge if you come to the booth. So come check it out, and we got a lot of cool stuff.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, thank you. That's pretty cheap, about 10 euros for your privacy. Okay, yeah, I'm curious what will turn out of your project in the end, so I hope you'll let us know. And of course, there's a lot of other stuff going on, but I'm sure you're all acquainted with the activity of exploring stuff, and so I don't want to spoil the fun. And just walk around, check it out, ask people, contact people, what are you doing there, what's happening here, and so on. So you'll find out, and you'll find your way around. And so that's it from me, and now I'm going to introduce our key speaker, John Gilmore. We're very proud to have him here, very pleased that he could come. He's a very prominent figure in the hacking scene as well. He has been around for quite some time. I believe he's the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the States, co-founder of the Cypherpunks as well as of the alt news groups on the Usenet. He has been developing and supporting many, many free software projects who have benefited from him a lot. But he's mostly known for his political activities in favor of privacy, of the freedom of information. He's involved into drug policy as well, and he just told me he's doing a lot on Guantanamo. And of course, he's concerned with the liberal society for the information age in general. It's like the theme behind all he's doing. And as I said before, I'm very pleased to have him here and announce him now. John Gilmore, everyone.
Nothing to hide. Nothing to hide. Do you have nothing to hide? I think the conference organizers have something to hide. Where are they keeping the money? Who has the passwords to the routers? I think nothing to hide is bullshit. And the interesting part is to figure out why. What's wrong with nothing to hide? I gave a speech in 1991 at the first conference on computers, freedom and privacy, in which I sort of laid out a bunch of goals and said, oh, this is what we technologists ought to be doing, you know, technology, social policy, privacy, etc. These were my goals. And I kind of want to go back over that and look at how we've done in the last 17 years at that. But nothing to hide. I asked, what if we could build a society where information was never collected? Where you could pay to rent a video without leaving a credit card number? Where you could prove that you're certified to drive without tying that into everything else you are? Without giving your name? Where you could send and receive messages without revealing your physical location? Sort of like using a post office box, but electronically. How have we done at providing that? I mean, in 1991, in my life, I was working on free software. The GNU C compiler worked on the VAX and the 68000. This was before the cypherpunks. Just a year into the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Where have we gone in the last 20 years? Are we better off? Are we worse off than we were in 1991? And the interesting part for me is that some of the things that we thought would be really useful turned out to be useless, and some of the things we never thought about were the things that actually provided us some help. So, for example, Wi-Fi is one of those things that was never really designed to cause social change. But in a sense, it has. When wandering around the city, you can often find your way onto the internet anonymously because the people who implemented Wi-Fi didn't really know their crypto very well. And they made it hard to configure and hard to work. And so people got used to just putting up open Wi-Fi nodes. That wasn't intentional, but it happened to work. On the other hand, a lot of things that people laid out as, oh, this is how we're going to save ourselves from the information totalitarianism, you know, haven't really worked. Sandra has a speech later today talking about what's wrong with data protection and how the promise of, oh, some large organization, a government, a Google, someone like that, will collect all the information and then promise not to be evil. Do we believe them? I can't hear you. Well, so what are you doing about it? When you want to go to a website, do you type its URL into your browser or do you type it into the Google search box? Do you teach your friends that you can type into the URL bar, not into the Google search box? So, I said, this is the society I want to build. I want to guarantee with privacy and mathematics, not with laws, that we can give our things real privacy of personal communications. Have we done that? We're all carrying around these useful portable computer tracking devices. Mine's not working very well because some sort of fight between the American and European versions of T-Mobile. But it's still tracking me. It even uses encryption. But it doesn't use it very well. And we have people here in the audience who have worked to make cell phones private. And a very small number of people are actually using private cell phones that do end-to-end encryption, that's real working encryption, instead of the bullshit stuff that they put out there to convince us to say things we shouldn't say over the telephone. But I would say that while we won the right to use encryption in the 90s, which was very much at risk, certainly in the United States and maybe in other places, what we didn't do was actually deploy it into the infrastructure. We have a small fringe of people who are using it, and that's a good thing, but we need to figure out how to grow that fringe to a much broader audience. In 1991, I was on the internet. Many people were not. There were probably more people on AOL and CompuServe, which were walled garden time-sharing systems, than on the internet. But the difference was the internet was designed to scale. They made a few little mistakes here and there, and that's caused endless amounts of trouble, like 32-bit addresses. But if you look back, the people who designed the IP protocols were running a network with about 50 nodes. They were either incredibly smart or incredibly lucky to have built stuff that would scale up. And part of the way they did it was building it decentralized. The routing system has no center. The Usenet, which actually predated the internet, has no center. It may have no substance left either. I think it runs on about 4 huge nodes, and everyone logs into it to read it, which sort of defeats the purpose now. But a lot of the other infrastructures didn't get built decentralized. They got built in a very centralized fashion. The cell phone networks, the identity credential issuance networks, all of those things have not succeeded in the hacker community versions of those have not succeeded. There are attempts, but we need to figure out how to make things that really scale up to world scale. The BitTorrent is an example of something that was designed from the beginning to scale. The Tor project was designed to scale, and it has crutches in it that don't scale, but the design, the theory, was that it could scale up to world size. So, I asked that we build encryption strong enough that even the NSA can't break it. I think we probably succeeded at that. But the problem is, we're not using it. Most of our email goes over the net in the clear. Even though we have protocols that will talk, I'm not even talking about end-to-end, I'm talking about link-level, sort of mail-server-to-mail-server encryption. We have protocols to automatically encrypt that, and most of it goes in the clear anyway, because we didn't figure out how to exchange keys or you do certificates, or we got hung up in X509 somewhere and got drowned in acronyms. The interwebs, you know, what a wonderful thing, but you have to go to extra work to do it encrypted. And so most people don't. Yeah. Meanwhile, while we were defeating the NSA in theory, they were defeating us in practice. Right? Besides wiretapping all of the people all over the world outside the United States, they're now wiretapping all of the people all the time inside the United States. The people who nominally have political control over them so far have not been able to exercise practical control over them. And at EFF, you know, as you all probably know, we're working on this. But it's really interesting when the branches of government kind of line up against control of the surveillance infrastructure, where it's the classic government model from 200 years ago in the United States was you have executive, legislative, and judicial branches, you have federal and state governments, and they all fight with each other, and none of them gets too powerful because they're all colliding with each other. Well, the executive branch is doing the wiretapping and defending the wiretapping and hiding it. The legislative branch, when push came to shove, decided that they would provide immunity to the people doing the wiretapping in open votes in the legislature. And the judicial branch, so far, has been interested in the question of whether any laws were broken, but so far has not seen fit to actually rule that if any laws are being broken, then it needs to stop. And part of that wiretap process that is less familiar to people, the state governments got involved as well. In the United States, telecommunications is regulated both by the federal government and by the states. And we had about 10 different public utilities commissions in different states start inquiries into whether the laws of that state have been broken about revealing personal information, tapping telephone infrastructure, etc. All of those lawsuits, all of those investigations were pulled into this whole nexus of federal lawsuits and have so far been stopped. So the basic structure of the government has not succeeded in providing checks and balances against a surveillance state. So what do you do about that? I can't hear you. I mean, governments change over the centuries, and people come up with new ideas, but I think we need some new ideas. This may not be the right crew to invent them, but it's certainly the right crew to understand why we need new ideas. Now, one of the people working on those sorts of ideas is David Brin, a science fiction author. He wrote a book called The Transparent Society. And I read that book when it came out. I read it before it came out and gave him some criticism, and he published it anyway. Which is good. And he didn't convince me of his ideas when I read the book, but he's been society has been convincing me more and more as I see how things have gone. His basic thesis is that accountability is more important than privacy as a social function, and that people with power in a society, whether it's political power, social power, economic power, use control of information to avoid accountability and to impose accountability on other people. who they're opposed to. And so I went, okay, well, I can see all of that stuff, but where are you going? Okay, and where he was going was to make a society in which even the powerful are accountable for following the laws, for following the customs of the society, for not screwing other people unduly. His prescription was that if there's a sensor, a surveillance sensor, then everyone should be able to see the records from that sensor. If the NSA can wiretap your phone calls, then you can wiretap your phone calls too. You can wiretap your friends' phone calls. You can wiretap the president's phone calls. I didn't like the implications of that. And that's why I rejected the book. But I'm starting to come to the conclusion that if you can't eliminate surveillance, then you have to make it give equal power to everybody. Because otherwise, what happens is what we see happening in front of us. That people who have a lot of power use that surveillance to remain unaccountable, and meanwhile, to hold all of us accountable. And to hold, in particular, their opponents accountable. And that doesn't build the kind of world I'd really want to live in. I mean, it's better, living in it is better than the alternative, but let's make some more alternatives. So, let's see. One of the things I talked about in 1991 was that the reason that we need privacy is because of hypocrisy, is because there are people with kind of split personalities where they say, this is the rules, but I actually do this. They say, oh, the rule is you're not allowed to use drugs to alter your consciousness. But here they are drinking coffee at 10 in the morning. or doing other things. And most people don't seem to quite get that. One thing that occurred to me is maybe a better way to explain it. Hypocrisy in a single person, you know, it's fairly common, but it's fairly innocuous. You know, you can catch them out at it if they're too egregious about it. But if you think of society, you know, as a person, as a body politic, of course there's going to be hypocrisy. Of course everyone in society is not going to agree about what the rules should be, and everyone in society is not going to agree about how they should act, what they should do in the world. And that's where privacy has been a social lubricant to say, okay, if you belong to this community, even though some part of society disapproves of you, you can keep doing the stuff you're doing. You can pray to this God if you want, and all those people who think your God is terrible, they won't even know, so don't worry about them. If we're actually going to build, if we're going to live in a society where everyone can see what everyone else is doing, we have to build a whole lot more tolerance, a whole lot less of the, oh, well, I can see him smoking a joint, so therefore he has to go to prison. And it's not clear how to do that either. Now, one of the issues I've been working on is identity. I mentioned it in the 1991 speech, but I put a lot more focus on it after 9/11. because I noticed, at least in the States, I don't know quite how it's been here, governments were paying a lot more attention to tracking the movements and communications and activities of individuals and building big dossiers about them. I understand in this physical location there used to be more of that going on, and now there's maybe less. But I think in other places in Europe, the trend has gone the other way, in the UK, for example. And certainly in the United States. And if you look at it, you can sort of see, I mean, the reason is obvious. If the government wants to, if a government or a large, you know, a place like Google or something like that, a large organization, wants to apply surveillance to its opponents without wasting its time and money surveilling everybody, which is still a little too expensive, they need to figure out who those opponents are, where they are. It's a way that, even though they can't put keyloggers in every keyboard, and they can't subvert the encryption, you know, in every iPhone and every laptop, if they can figure out, oh, this is his laptop, this is his checked bag, let's look at it. If this is his or her movements, let's see who he or she is talking to. Then they can imply the really intrusive surveillance in a way that the average person never figures out. And all it takes for that to work is for the average person to say, oh, it's of course I'll show my ID anytime you ask. Right? I have nothing to hide. Yes, this is me, John Gilmore, getting on an airplane. But what that gives away is the ability to target the people who do matter. Even if you don't matter. So I've been living in the United States without an ID. I have a passport, and I use it to escape the country. But I don't use it inside the country, because I was taught that internal passports were a really bad idea, that they were totalitarian. Well, the United States has internal passports now. And as a result, I can't fly around in my own country. I can't take trains. Some of the buses are identity checked. Some are not. So some places I can go, but some places I can't. And you guys will have to tell me and tell yourselves, you know, how is that going in Europe? When the borders came down, there's less insistence on identity. But you know, when I flew from Amsterdam to here yesterday, I got to the front of the line. Besides looking at my boarding pass, they wanted to see my passport. I asked them why. They said, oh, identity check. Well, yeah, okay, so why? Well, they didn't have an answer, but without it, I couldn't get on the plane. Why do you put up with that? Why do you let your countries be used to track you everywhere you go? Because you have no say in the matter? I don't think that's true. Well, so, nothing to hide. Well, I have something hiding in here. And I'll use it as my closing statement. I thought about going all the way down to the buff. But I think this is a better message. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Any questions to John?
Comments?
Still have a very few minutes.
It's a picture of Osama bin Laden. It says, "I'm still free. What about you?"
Any questions, comments?
I have one.
Yes?
What am I running on my XO? I'm running Debian.
Ah.
Right.
How do you get your developer signature?
The XO laptop comes with built-in DRM. It's a TiVoized machine. And you can't reflash it without permission from its creators. However, this permission is called a developer key, and you can get it by going through the OLPC website. There's a link on your OLPC for how to get a developer key, and then you can install it, and then you can run whatever you want, sort of like any old PC. I didn't hear the question.
Don't you think it's kind of odd that you have to ask permission to use your own machine any way you want?
Do I think it's odd that I have to ask permission to use my machine any way I want to? Abso-fucking-lutely. Yes. In fact, I've had a lot of interactions with the One Laptop for Child project about that issue. I believe they are currently in violation of the GNU public license because of their DRM scheme, violating both the GPL version 3 for TiVoization and also GPL version 2, just because hundreds of thousands of children in the third world have received these laptops with binaries and no source code. The ones that are on the internet can sort of batter their way through a series of websites and figure out where the source code is. I mean, I've been hacking on these things for a couple years and still I have some trouble finding different bits of the source code for it. But the ones who aren't on the internet have no access to the source code. And they need to figure out how to fix that.
I think that's it for my questions.
Okay. Do I have any ID or idea whether the situation in the U.S. will change based on the new government? Well, personally, I didn't vote for the guy.
We have Republicans.
I think it's a really good sign that the United States was able to elect a nigger president. I'm allowed to say that because I'm from Alabama. I think it's a really positive sign, but I don't think that his policies on whether the government should be bigger and have more control over individuals are any better than the Bush administration's policies on that. Only time will tell.
I've got one question to you, John. You talked about accountability versus, this thing of privacy. Well, accountability, I guess we can all agree, is something important too, but the question of personal accountability versus government's accountability is a question of enforcement of policies. Because you've got good rules in theory about accountability of people being in charge in governments, running surveillance state machines or whatever. And in theory, when they violate, you know, privacy laws, yes, they go to jail. In practice, they do not, because they are the same guys enforcing the rules. So what about our abilities to enforce rules, which brings, of course, direct the question from a German point of view, of resistance. to technology that allows accountability only, enforcement of accountability only one way. So what's your thought on that? So because Sandro, who's today the moderator, and that's why he maybe doesn't ask the question, made a thought 1 or 2 years ago that, yes, we have the right to sabotage technology that is putting surveillance on us but doesn't allow us to, you know, look at those guys who run the machine running, watching us. So this game of we watching them, watching us, which is the theoretical peace of mind of this whole thing, so that we can at least watch them doing what they're doing, has its gaps.
Well, clearly it has gaps, yes. But what is this distinction between us and them you're talking about?
Well,
I mean...
No, the distinction is that they have the tools to enforce the policies. We do not have that tool sometimes. We might have the tools to, you know, protect our privacy. But me putting the government into jail, well, that's, you know...
Well, we're going to be facing that issue in the United States very soon.
Thank you.
One of the issues, this is absolutely an issue, one of the issues in different legal systems is how much power it gives to ordinary individuals to enforce their rights. In the United States, an individual has much more power to enforce their rights against the government. They can't prosecute someone, they can't put someone in prison for violating their rights, but they can have the courts go in, make an affirmative declaration and an order that their rights be respected. And this is what gave EFF, for example, the power to go and sue the NSA and to go and sue AT&T and the other phone companies when we think they did something wrong. That aspect of American society has been very heavily criticized worldwide. It's a litigious society. It has too many lawyers making too much trouble, wasting too much money. It comes at a cost. Is the cost worth it? You have to decide that for your own country. For the really big issues, things like genocide, war crimes, torture, we have this concept of universal jurisdiction that has gradually been evolving that says even if the courts that have ordinary jurisdiction over those crimes refuse to act, especially if they refuse to act, courts in any country in the world can take up those issues. And courts in several European countries have been at the forefront of applying universal jurisdiction to war crimes. It remains to be seen whether Donald Rumsfeld will ever again be able to fly to Europe. Yes. More questions?
Don't be shy. We're all friends.
Yes.
Can you give us 3 or 4 things that we should do? What can we do?
That's a good question.
Three or four things that you can do. Well, it's a hard one. It really depends on you and where what your skills are and where you fit in the world.
Well, because earlier you were saying or you were implying that encryption is something that we could all use. You know, something like that.
Well, certainly, yes, you can use more encryption. Part of the reason that people don't use encryption is because we've made it too hard to do so. Right, so one of the challenges, one way to deal with that challenge is for a small number of people to take it on themselves to use that hard stuff and figure out how to make it easier. And that's something that this community can do, is knock the rough edges off that stuff so that it becomes possible for your grandmother to use it without really noticing that she's got more privacy. Beyond that, I wish I knew. I'm here not to tell you the answers, but to hopefully learn some from you.
I have some answers. Come to my talk.
Yeah.
Okay, any further questions? Well, maybe I have... Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, in the back. What's the point of accountability for everyone if you only have a subset of the society making the laws that everyone has to follow? Well, that again is another big social challenge, a challenge of how to organize your society. I can mostly only speak to the American experience, which is the American government was designed that a majority could do most things but could not do some things, because doing certain things like restricting other people's ability to speak or move around freely or their privacy from being searched at any point, etc., those were considered too dangerous to the openness of the society. Clearly, in the last 200 years, that framework has not worked as well as it should have. In particular, the prohibition on searches without warrants has been routinely ignored by all branches of government. And that has brought us to the surveillance society we're living in today. The protection of freedom of speech has been much stronger. And again, this is something that the United States is criticized for allowing people to say things that many people in Europe wish would not be said. But it has come at a cost. One of the interesting things there is a nonprofit organization, the American Civil Liberties Union, grew up in the last 100 years mostly to enforce that right, the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, etc. And I think that's a large part of the reason that it still exists. So it's, you know, and it's not so much that those rules got written down inside the government, it's that people got up on their hind legs and said, no, when you violate this, we're gonna fight this out with you. And that actually gives me a little bit more hope that even when the government goes wrong in one way or another, if enough people out in society get upset about it, they can make it change. Yes.
So, you were talking about the abuse of identity cards and how they were used to track us across all over the world. When I'm thinking about the key signing party, the PGP key signing party, most of the time you have to present your ID card. It seems to be in conflict with the creation of an alternative trust relationship. What are your thoughts on this topic?
I never presented an ID card to get my PGP key signed. and fake IDs are readily available if you need one. Yeah?
I have a little problem with what you said, because for me privacy is very important too, but there are a lot of people who are making other people suffering by violence, by stealing their money or something like that. And I think it's really important to track them down, to find them, to stop them. But the question is how to find the right ones if you don't track down anybody else.
Right. Well, traditionally, there's been a clear divide between tracking down crimes after they happen and tracking them down before they happen. And that line was breached after 9/11, and I believe incorrectly. I think that the world got way too crazy about trying to stop every possible act of terrorism, not realizing that most acts of terrorism are not really all that terrible. Right? That in the United States, they blew up, what, 2 or 3 buildings? We had millions and millions more buildings if we needed them. Right? In one day, we had 5,000 people lose their lives. That week, 5,000 more people lost their lives due to heart attacks. And the next week, 5,000 more lost their lives due to heart attacks. And the next week, 5,000 more. But everybody took their attention off of the heart attacks and put all their attention on stopping that one-time loss of life. Right? I just think it was an overemphasis that needs to be corrected before we can get back to a balance that will actually protect us from crimes after they happen. You can't protect yourself from a crime after it happens, but you can deter it and you can bring those people to justice. But instead, what I think has happened is the world has become less likely to bring people to justice. There is more secrecy, less accountability. The people who are brought to justice are as often innocent as guilty. I've been working to free the people in Guantanamo for many years now. I've been supporting lawyers who have been succeeding gradually in the courts to get them out. I am paying tuition at university for 3 different former Guantanamo residents. And I'm now running on reserve battery power.
Yes, it's nice that you mentioned 9/11. My question is about the media coverage. I mean, a lot of people, the average population, get the main perception of the world through the media, through the mainstream media. And my question is, since 9/11, we've witnessed a major uprise in the whole terrorist issue in the media, and not just the real life coverage, but also fictionally. Series like 24 promote all those cool prosecution methods, which are called hacking. We all know better that stuff that they show in 24 and the like are not real hacking. But they show how they can track people electronically, and in the end, the good guys always win. Isn't it a matter of the authors that fictional stories always influence the way how people perceive the real life, the history, future, and present? If we want to change the way people react on the statement, nothing to hide, wasn't it crucial to influence the fictional culture in a way to question the current behavior patterns of surveillance and security reliance?
Yes. But also, one of the useful things that happened with the internet is that the media is much less centralized than it was 20 years ago. And so we are the media, and we can create those stories.
Anyone else? We still have a few minutes.
Yes.
I recently read an essay by Bruce Schneier, and he says that for preventing terrorism, you need really good intelligence. And not checking everyone's IP and people. But doing really good intelligence is still important. What's your opinion on that?
He says he read something from Bruce Schneier, who said that to catch terrorists, you need really good intelligence. You don't need to be checking everybody's IDs all the time. And if Bruce said it, I believe it. Yeah.
Jake. Things like
WikiLeaks, and maybe what each of us can do in our daily lives anonymously to maybe record phone calls of our elected officials and leak them onto the internet. And do you see any value in these things?
He asked about the leaking of documents, use of WikiLeaks and other things, and what can we do to maybe record our interactions with public officials and things and put them out in the public. I think this is a good thing. Again, there are pluses and minuses to this kind of leakage. Some people in the UK are losing their jobs over the leak that they belong to a particular political party because that's considered a racist party. On the other hand, in the last 2 weeks, I guess I've seen the censorship lists from two or three different countries posted on WikiLeaks. Very, very interesting. If you go to those websites from other countries, you can see what they're concerned about you not reading. As for recording your interactions with politicians, it's interesting, but it's really kind of a sideline. The most interesting leaks come out of people working in the government.
Not my interactions.
Yes.
Their interactions.
Recording their internal interactions inside the government?
Sure.
Interestingly, some of the worst governments, it'll be interesting to see what happens after the Bush administration leaves office to see how many records are left of what they were doing. Right? The most totalitarian organizations tend to leave the best records. There's a project happening now in Guatemala where there was 30 years of civil war in Guatemala that only ended in the 90s, and the national police were involved in a long campaign of disappearances, tortures, murders of political opponents. A few years ago, a huge building full of paper records was discovered in Guatemala City, in this sort of police compound. The neighbors were concerned that the building might have munitions in it and that it might threaten their neighborhood. So they sent the Ombudsman for Human Rights in to look at it. And what they discovered was 110 years worth of full records of the National Police, including like 70 or 80 years when they were a reasonable police force, and another 30 years when they were raping, pillaging, murdering, and torturing. And currently the effort is just to save those records, is to sift through them, scan in as many as we can, get them into safeguard before someone throws a bomb into the building and destroys them all, who doesn't want accountability. And then, you know, you'll spend the next 50 years with sociologists trying to figure out how did a good police force go bad. But I just saw an interesting article about the Nixon, the Watergate issues that drove President Nixon out of office. The leaker has been known for a few years to have been the number two guy in the FBI who alerted the Washington Post to the president's activities in bugging his political opponents and eventually brought down the president. And the thesis of this new article was this guy was not only doing it because he thought the Constitution and the democracy was being violated or whatever, he was doing it because he was passed over for promotion to the head of the FBI. He was investigating what the White House was doing and had information that he could leak when he wasn't supposed to be investigating the White House. Right? So this was part of the secret police using leaks to get at their political opponents. You know, it's all kind of a mess. It's a moral mess. But it's the sort of mess we have to work through to make a more tolerant society.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, we have to close asking questions. I think you can talk to John afterwards. He'll be here for a couple of days. I probably have one final question that's more of a criticism of what you said in 91. Shall we do that in public?
Yeah? Sure.
Okay. In the blue corner. The thing is, I had the impression that I know you're a liberal thinker and with Popper's Open Society and everything, but from your 91 position, I had the impression that it was also a bit of a neoliberal thinker, you know, placing a lot of emphasis on the free market and even suggesting to make privacy a commodity to probably bring it to the market, bring it to the people over the market. And I mean, now seeing the financial crisis and seeing all the interest in the economy over the past years in data mining and databases and using surveillance as a means of power, would you still uphold that part of your conviction as well?
I'm still a believer in the free market because it's a decentralized system. One of the things I really find fascinating about it is if there's something you want to do in the world, and you can convince maybe four or five people from anywhere in the world to give you 10,000 euros a year to pursue that, then you can do it. And you don't need permission from anybody. You don't need to fill out any forms, apply. You know, if you can collect 40 or 50,000 euros, you can live and have a home and raise your children and also do the work. And you can raise that money from customers, you can raise it from individual donations to nonprofits, however it is. It's a very widely decentralized system that protects our ability to follow our own muses in that sense. Privacy as a commodity is not a... It doesn't seem to be a really working model for me. I think most people are willing to sell their privacy for a very small amount of commodity, and because they don't realize really what they're giving up in the process. It's like that typing your URLs into the Google search bar. Okay?
Okay. I'd still have a few questions, but we do that in private. Okay, so thank you, John. Yes. And. Congress is officially open. I hope you all have a good time, splendid time, informative time, and I'll see you all in 4 days. Thank you.